Welcome to Chip Chat, an interview series that connects you with technology experts around the issues that industry is focused on today. And now your host, Allison Klein.
Welcome to Chip Chat. We're back live from the Intel Developer Forum. It's day two at IDF. Today we've talked about mission critical computing and storage, and now we're going to shift focus to multi-core computing and parallel programming. And I've got James Reinders with us in the studio. Welcome, James.
Thanks for having me.
So, James, why don't you tell me about what you do at Intel, the group that you work in, and why we have this focus at Intel?
My passion has always been making computers go very fast, and parallel programming has always been part of that. So, you know, with the advent of multi-core processors, back, you know, the last 5 or 6 years now, that's become a topic that's been important to everybody. Mm-hmm. So it's gone from the world of being purely an HPC topic for, you know, the supercomputers of the world. How do you do parallel programming on those to, you know, how do all of us take advantage of the parallelism of multi-core chips? So that's pretty much defines my life these days, is, you know, working with software developers and working with the tools from Intel that we produce, and, you know, helping connect those so that they help solve problems, challenges that software developers face.
Before we go further, I want to remind the audience that they can submit questions live on Blog Talk Radio or at Intel Chip Chat on Twitter. You know, you brought up an interesting point, James. You know, I think that a lot of people in technology think that when we delivered the first dual-core processor, people started talking about parallelism. But there was an entirely earlier focus on parallelism in the high-performance computing space and development of high-performance compute architectures and clusters. You worked on the ASCII RED
supercomputer.
Yep. Thank you, which is the first teraflop supercomputer. What in HPC has developed the concepts of parallelism? Let's start there.
Well, you know, there's the earliest supercomputers for HPC really took off and were capable of a lot more than, say, regular computers because they emphasized vector parallelism. So if you look at the Cray supercomputers that, you know, emerged in the 80s, they emphasized processing a lot of data at once. The same sort of things we saw show up in microprocessors, such as, you know, using SSE instructions or now AVX, these vector instructions. So that was the first form of parallelism. That's several decades ago. Mm-hmm. ASCII RED was a real milestone, not just in being a teraflop supercomputer, but really proving that hooking thousands and thousands of microprocessors together could form an effective supercomputer. So in essence, you had a not just the data parallelism of vector units, but you had this task parallelism, if you will, the multiple processors. In fact, we had more than 9,000 processors in that system. So we've really been pushing the envelope in both areas in the high-performance computing area. What can you do with data parallelism and task parallelism? And a lot of programming techniques and tools and learnings have come out of decades of that effectively are sitting there waiting for us to figure out how to harvest all those learnings and apply them every day.
It sounds like we've taken all of those concepts down to the chip level with multi-core and applied them across market segments. So your focus on parallelism extends beyond HPC today. What types of applications are you looking at driving parallel computing for?
You know, the simplest answer to that, even it takes some time to think about what the implications are. The simplest answer is anything that handles a lot of data. And that's gotten to be almost everything these days. You know, embedded devices, routers, cell phones, so forth, handle an amazing amount of data. You know, negotiating with a cell tower to create a secure connection mm-hmm. is data intensive. Routers do that. Anything that handles video or audio handles a lot of data. Of course, in the supercomputing arena, we talk about extreme amounts of data and computations, but the reason I mentioned routers and cell phones, cameras, is to sort of say, at perhaps either end of the spectrum, you see a huge amount of data, and we love to collect data, process it, use it. We want our computers to help us manage that, interpret it. That's really where the essence of compute power will be. So we see this virtually in any area. Any computer program you can imagine has the opportunity to use parallel processing. It just takes a little bit of imagination. It's not just the high sciences anymore that we apply, extreme amounts of compute power to.
Where are we in terms of the transition to parallelism in broad compute development?
I think it's fair to say that pretty much every computer and to some extent every application is touched by parallelism one way or another. It comes in a lot of different forms. First of all, we expect the ability to run multiple applications on most of our devices now, and that requires, to get good performance, it requires parallelism in the processors themselves. So as you switch between multiple apps, it'll be much more responsive that way. Also, a lot of things like even HTML is increasingly able to take advantage of parallelism. Browsers are built to do things in parallel. So a lot of the user interfaces we have are parallel, even if the applications aren't. So that has taken enormous strides, and there's still opportunity. I think when a lot of people ask the question that you posed, they get very focused on, does a particular application use parallelism? Does a particular program get written? In that regard, it's interesting. I would say we're just at the earliest stages of that because I can see a lot of opportunity before us. But if you poll software developers, you'll frequently see surveys that say 80% of developers say that they're working on a parallel application. And that can be rather puzzling because when you look at what they're counting for that, it might just be calling a library that does parallelism. It might be just a little limited use of OpenMP or Intel threading building blocks. But it's out there, and it's I think a majority of developers have picked up a little bit of something, how they can harness parallelism. So we have that traction, but I see a long journey ahead and a lot of opportunities for tools and learning to help.
So when you look at this from an Intel perspective, obviously we have some big reasons why we want a macro shift towards parallel programming. What is the end state that we're looking for? I mean, when would you say, I've accomplished maybe not everything, but enough that I can feel like this mega task is done?
Wow, that's not a very traditional way to look at anything in our industry as being done. What an interesting question. One of the things I really love working at Intel as a software practitioner, as an expert with parallelism, because the trends we see in hardware, the multi-core and so forth from Intel, that's a shift the entire industry has. It's not something unique to Intel chips that the world's going parallel. So our interest in helping the software ecosystems all move there, it's a great place to work on the problem because we're not beholden to one particular operating system or one programming language. We're eager to see all of them. So as you present the question, there's always yet another programming language to help adopt parallelism or another operating environment. But I think the big milestones I see ahead of us, we've seen very broad adoption of some techniques that help solve the problem for C++, Intel threading building blocks. There's a push underway now to look at how can we add things standard to those languages, C and C++. I think we'll see that easily within the next decade. I shouldn't say easily for anything, but the big question is how fast that is. But one day I'll wake up and in C and Fortran and Java, and the .NET languages will see parallelism as a first-class citizen in those languages, which mm-hmm. isn't today. It's something you sort of bolt on to the side. And then, if anything, I could wake up that day and say, okay, my job's done. At least as you were asking me about it today, have we made progress that's extremely notable? The day that it's a first-class citizen in those languages, that'll be a big change in how people look at parallelism.
When we look at the investment that Intel is making in this space, I know that we're driving a lot of tools to the industry, but we're also driving some major initiatives. And one that I'd heard of recently is Silk Plus. Can you tell me about that?
Absolutely. I mentioned I love working on these problems at Intel, and one of the things I love about it is we want to help the whole industry move forward. So it's a very standards-oriented approach. We're not looking to create a proprietary tool or a proprietary language. We had enormous success with our introduction of Intel Threading Building Blocks back in 2006. And that really caught fire. It's been ported to so many different operating environments. It solved parallelism for C++ using a template library approach.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the debates you have in programming languages is should you try to solve a problem with a library mm-hmm. or a language change? And
okay.
people resist language change because, you know, you want to make sure you know what you're doing. Well, a couple of years ago, we acquired a company called Silk Arts. We acquired their technology and people. They were looking at how to do the key parts of threading building blocks effectively as a language extension for C and C++. Silk Plus is that project, and we've implemented it in our compiler for Windows, Linux, Mac, and then we are giving it away, the technology. So we open sourced the library, which is an immense undertaking, and there's a branch on the GNU compiler now looking at integrating that and showing what it would look like if it was integrated with the GNU compilers, and we've published the specification for it as an open spec. Really trying to help that conversation of how C and C++ should evolve for parallelism, but with more than just talk, by doing an implementation, by having a product compiler you can try, by having coursework out of MIT that can show how to use it in the classroom. I think Silk Plus is a wonderful way to extend the language. I personally think we've done a great job, but the objective here isn't to say, well, Silk Plus is the answer, everyone has to adopt it. It's to create that conversation that's only possible by trying it, by refining it, by having a industry-wide dialogue. And I can say the excitement here at IDF alone over this has been even surprised me, how many people have stopped us and come to our classes and ask us a lot about this, want to participate, want to help out, because there's a lot of built-up interest in that. So Silk Plus is that. It's Intel's proposal on how C and C++ can adopt parallelism, but in a more than just a paper form, in a very practical form. Every software developer can go download and try it out and give feedback.
And what has been the industry response to it so far?
Extremely positive. People have been looking for how we might standardize this. Everybody knows when you standardize a language, then you can build up software, interchangeable software. You can get tools that understand the language extension and make the whole experience of writing an app, debugging it better. You know, they know what keywords to highlight in the editor. They know what to debug. So people understand the power of standardization. So stepping forward and saying the time's right to look at standardizing these features, people understand the value of that, and they want to know how can they help, how can they experiment with it, how they can give feedback on it.
You know, you brought up a couple of things. You brought up the fact that parallelism is being bolted on the side. You brought up educating programmers. I have a question on that topic in a few seconds, but at first, we're going to go to a break, and I'd just like to remind the audience to submit questions online at Blog Talk Radio through the chat window, or on Twitter at Intel Chip Chat. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more of Allison's interview. Have a question? Visit us at twitter.com/IntelChipChat. We'll be answering questions live next.
And we're back live from IDF. This is Chip Chat. I'm Allison Klein, and I'm here with James Reinders from our SSG group. We are talking about education and the efforts that we have to drive education around parallelism. And you brought up something around bolted on its side, parallelism efforts in some of applications today. Can you talk a little bit about what we're doing on a deeper level and educating the next generation of software developers to maybe take a more organic approach to parallelism?
Oh, absolutely. This is a topic I'm very passionate about, and there are quite a few of us at Intel that have been trying to figure out how we can help. A number of years ago, we started an academic program reaching out to professors around the world and saying, you know, how can we create a community, a dialogue on this? We have nearly 3,000 different universities participating around the world, exchanging information. So there's a intel.com/thinkparallel, I think is roughly it. But if you search for Think Parallel, you can find out about this program. One of the big topics that came up was a strong belief that parallelism isn't something you should just wait and teach after you've taught programming. Mm-hmm. It's perhaps much more difficult to understand after we've taught programming the way that it's evolved on a serial machine, because you introduce the concepts too late. You've already taught data structures, but you didn't teach the implications of concurrency on which is the right data structure. You pick them based on other issues. So I think when you're teaching data structures, you need to introduce the concept of concurrency a little bit. Mm-hmm. When you start teaching programming, introduce some basic concepts like map, reduce, and so forth. So we're still learning as an industry how to do that, but I'm very much convinced that it needs to be integrated into teaching parallel programming from the start. I think trivial parallel programming or straightforward things like MapReduce could be taught as the very first program someone writes, and it's a very rewarding thing to do. A few years ago, a few friends and I, we went and taught a summer week-long class at Brooklyn Tech High School to see if we could grab some programmers that hadn't been quite as cast in their ways. And it was really exciting and invigorating, because they didn't have some of the burdens of that those of us who have been programming a few decades have in our thinking. And they were very quick to grasp the concepts. And I think they can be intuitive for anybody, but they're much more difficult when they're bolted on later.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And perhaps as the next wave of natural parallel programming, I would assume, is when you don't have to retrain the mind to do something, that it comes as the obvious choice.
Absolutely. And I think some of the things we're pushing for in changing languages or extending them will give options that make it easier to teach. I think it doesn't occur to people that a simple do loop in Fortran or a for loop in C or C++ or Java, that those are sequential programming methods. When a programmer says for I equals 0 to a million, what they actually said is do iteration 1 and then 2 and then 3 and then 4. They didn't say you could do all of them in parallel. That's just a mistake. So there's a lot of subtle things that'll change. Programming languages, teaching methods. We'll get some books out there. I'm working with some co-authors on a crazy idea of writing another book on how to do parallel programming. I hope it's a step forward. I think it will be, but I think we have a lot to learn yet about how to teach this most effectively.
We got a question from the audience. You talked about library delivery. You've talked about educational initiatives. Someone's surprised that we have a software division doing all of this. Can you tell us a little bit about the software group and the kinds of tools and programs that you guys deliver?
Absolutely. I think of the tools that we deliver in four different spaces. We have compilers, and libraries that provide extraordinary performance. We work very hard to be the leaders with optimization technology in our libraries and our compilers, so that someone running x86 code, you know, hopefully on an Intel processor, but an Intel processor compatible, can get great application performance. We've got tools that can help analyze and find faults in a program. This has actually really taken off with parallelism, because there are some new forms of parallel programming errors that can happen that we can help detect efficiently. And then finally, we've got performance tuning. So the performance tuning, the lead product there is something called VTune. It has a much longer official name, but everybody just calls it VTune. It's been with us a few decades. And has actually caused our chips to evolve. There are features in our microprocessors to support VTune that collect data that VTune can show, so it's an extremely accurate way of knowing exactly what your programs, your application, the whole system is doing. And in the hands of someone that wants to tune an application or a system, it's incredible. So they're all worth taking a look at. The compilers are extremely compatible with Microsoft and with the GNU compilers, and so they work on Windows, on Linux, on Mac OS to give excellent performance. They're widely used. We've got a very large following of users. A lot of applications that people use every day are compiled with our tools and not with other compilers necessarily when people are looking for high performance. VTune's very widely used for performance tuning, and we're seeing a lot of uptake on our analysis tools for programming errors as well. All of them are available to try out for free for evaluation copies off of the software website. So it's intel.com/software/products.
You know, you mentioned that VTune has inspired some microprocessor changes. And since we're on the topic of Intel Software Division, what is the interplay between hardware development and software optimization, and how does that work at Intel?
Yeah, I think this is one of the greatest benefits of Intel having a software group. In particular, of course, the software tools group works with software developers and gets feedback. And, you know, we have these great ideas on how to add features into our microprocessors, but by having experts at Intel that actually try to translate that into software solutions that use the hardware, in a way we feel the pain if there is some of the hardware design. So we have very strong interactions with the hardware team, helping give not only our feedback, but the more importantly, the customer feedback. But we're able to understand the software challenges at using the hardware. And if there are opportunities to evolve the hardware, we understand that, and we can be very persistent with the hardware groups to have back and forth dialogue. Of course, our hardware teams are world experts at implementing things and understand the limitations of their technologies and what they can implement, what they can and can't at what points in time. So we have this great dialogue back and forth, and over the years, that's made Intel microprocessors very strong at being able to deliver value that software actually takes advantage of, because we have both capabilities at Intel.
For our last topic in the interview, I'm going to go back to your roots with high-performance computing and take parallelism to the extreme with many-core. We've been talking about many-core for a while in the HPC space. Tell us about MIC and what we're doing to drive extreme parallelism in specific sets of HPC workloads, and how does that work with our Xeon model for high-performance computing?
Yeah, there's going back to my HPC roots and my love of computer architecture, there's a pretty classic problem in computer architecture, which is, should you build a processor to be really sophisticated and run a single program really fast, or should you build, and if you go parallel, should you have a few of those really powerful processors hooked together, or should you get something that's simpler, a simpler design, and have lots of them? And there have been many, many different computers built over the years exploring the extremes of that. And I think what we've learned from that is if you go too low on the performance on a processor, it's ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
So we've taken a very high performance processor, but more akin to a Pentium era processor that doesn't try to speed up a single thread of execution as much as a Xeon. And you can fit more of those on a die at once. So today, Sandy Bridge EP can have 8 cores on a die. On a die of similar size, you might be able to get a few dozen of a smaller core. So the question is, would you rather have a few dozen or have 8?
Mm-hmm.
So the MIC architecture really explores this. So the Mini Integrated Core is an effort. We have a prototype system. It has 30 or 32 cores on a chip. We don't sell it, but we're working with a lot of people to explore what that means. And we'll have a production version of it in the future with more than 50 cores.
Mm-hmm.
But each one of those cores is really designed with the knowledge that it's part of a parallel processor and that its job is to only run parallel programs really fast. A Xeon processor is designed to both run a parallel program fast, but also a workload that includes a lot of different jobs and things, something that's pretty much what we expect of a computer today.
Mm-hmm.
And that is incredibly important. That is the bulk of the market. But there is a higher-end desire, a high-end need, especially in HPC, to look at if you have a highly parallel problem, could this other design option benefit us? Underlying all of it, though, is we believe that the same programming model should work both places. So
mm-hmm.
all of our tools, programs, x86 programs that run on a cluster can run either on a cluster of Xeons or on a MIC coprocessor. And you don't have to give up. You don't need to recode your program just because of one choice or the other. So we're exploring a space. I think there's going to be a strong market for this type of an architecture, complementing and extending Xeon architecture. And we'll learn a lot from it and see where that takes us on this wild ride of always trying to make computers faster and faster.
Well, James, I've really enjoyed the conversation today. You've taken us on a history tour and a look at the future on parallelism. Where can people find out more information if they want to connect with you after this episode is over or want to learn more about the programs that you mentioned?
You know, Intel has a website, intel.com/software, the Intel Software Network. I blog there. I'm not too hard to find, hopefully. And there's information about our software products there. There's information in the forums about discussions on all the topics we cover. So, you know, a little bit of search engine work and look at intel.com/software, and I think people can connect up with me or with anyone else at Intel working on these things.
Well, thanks so much for being here today.
My pleasure.